Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at The Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, Bill Galston of The Wall Street Journal and the Brookings Institution, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is Michael Isikoff, who has a new book out with his colleague Daniel Kleidman called Find Me the Votes. And Michael, thanks so much for joining us. This is a very important book. You did a tremendous amount of research and about Trump's attempt to subvert the 2020 election. And there's a lot of meat here. So I would like to begin, though, with something, so we can get into the whole Fani Willis controversy later, because I gather that when you finished the book, the news had not broken about her relationship with Nathan Wade and all of that. And frankly, that's kind of a sideshow. The fact is, you so clearly outline in this book, and you broke some news, but you so clearly outline the nature of the attempt. So if you would, can you address for a minute the fake electors scheme? Because people just toss it off and they mention it.
Right.
But what comes through so clearly in your book is that, but for Mike Pence, this very well could have worked. They had these slates of fake electors that they had sort of certified in various states. If Mike Pence had said he wasn't counting certain electoral votes on January 6th, there were all of these Republicans in the House and Senate who stood ready. As we know, they didn't certify the election, who stood ready to say, nope, we're going to send it back to the states. And then those fake electors might have been counted, right? So it came pretty close to working, didn't it?
Well, it certainly was something that could have created unbelievable disruption in our country. It had succeeded. And first of all, I am glad that you're focusing on the substance of what we write about here. We've all been distracted by the salacious controversy over Fani Willis and the relationship. But as our book shows, the real meat here, the real part of this that people should focus on is what took place. And we focused on Georgia because Georgia was the crime scene. It was the place where Trump's efforts to overturn the election were most furious, most intense, most relentless, and went further than anywhere else. So if you want to sort of take a step back for everything that went on right through to January 6th, you really have to start with what happened in Georgia. And when you focus on each and every step that was taken along the way, you see the enormity of what Trump was trying to pull off. And the fake elector scheme is a classic example of that. It was only one of many elements in what Fani Willis has charged as a racketeering conspiracy. But, it sort of crystallized the lengths to which the MAGA crowd under Trump's direction were prepared to go. Trump had lost in Georgia. It was the state where he was closest, but it was still a pretty decisive defeat, 779 votes at the time. And that's not the kind of thing that's easily overcome in a recount. And there had been three recounts under Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, and in each one, Trump came up short. So Trump and his confederates, began looking for other ways to overturn the results of the election. And as we explain, Georgia was sort of the key because it was the state Trump assumed he had in his pocket, Republican office holders up and down the board from governor to attorney general to lieutenant governor to secretary of state, Republican legislature. And it was the closest. So they figured if they could flip Georgia, that could create the domino effect that would get other states. And it's all they needed to create as much commotion on January 6th to get Pence to reject the Biden electors. So one element was this fake elector scheme dreamed up by John Eastman, blessed by Trump, implemented in part by Rudy Giuliani, and, you know, all the way down right through to the guy, Mike Roman, who I'm sure we'll come back to, one of the co-defendants, who was the implementer of the scheme, sending out notices to everybody on the ground in each of the battleground states. Here are the Trump electors we need to meet. Here's where what time they have to be there. Here's what they have to sign. Here's how we make this happen. And in Georgia, the chairman of the Georgia Republican Party, David Schaefer, a Trump backer all the way, took his guidance from the Trump crowd and convened this meeting with no public announcement of it. In fact, everybody was told to keep quiet about it. Assemble on the second floor of the state capitol on December 14th, and they will anoint themselves as the legitimate electors from the state of Georgia. And that was the plan. In some states, people realized the sort of how outlandishness of all of this and demanded in two states, put in language that says this is only contingent on a court overturning. In Georgia, they didn't do that. They just signed these documents calling themselves the legitimate electors from the state of Georgia. And that is one of the elements in the racketeering conspiracy case.
Yeah. So one of the great things about your book is that you document some of the heroes we didn't know about, some Republican officials in Georgia, including this young Jordan Fuchs, who was the assistant to Raffensperger, who was, I mean, talk about poise and presence of mind. I mean, she comes off incredibly well in your account that, you know, and it was her decision apparently to tape record that famous phone call, which had huge, huge effects. But she did more than that. But I want to also just touch on the craziness of the people that Trump was very close to and taking advice from in the midst of all of this. So you talk about the brain trust at Tamatli Plantation, which is the home of Lynn Wood. This is not political commentary. I mean, I think the bar in Georgia declared that he was like not of sound mind, or somebody declared that.
It requested that he submit to a psychiatric evaluation in order to maintain his law license in the state of Georgia.
Okay.
And rather than do that, Lynn Wood surrendered his license to practice law in Georgia.
So this is one of the key figures advising the then president of the United States, along with Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell, and the guy who is thought to be the sort of spearhead of the whole QAnon conspiracy.
Right. Right.
So that's the brain trust.
This is the chapter that blows people's minds when they read it. Chapter 6. It's the QAnon Commission. Because just to sort of walk through what happened here is right after the election, Donald Trump Jr. flies down to Atlanta and has these series of meetings at Buckhead Republican headquarters and announces that Lynn Wood is coming to the rescue to lead up the president's legal fight in Georgia. In fact, Kimberly Guilfoyle, his girlfriend, like calls him up on his cell phone, puts her cell phone on the chair. Everybody's listening. And, you know, Lynn Wood is rah-rah. I'm here to save the day. Lynn Wood at this point is a full-blown QAnon acolyte. He has adopted the QAnon slogan for one week, you know, for
where we go one, we go all.
Where we go one, where we go all, on his Twitter account. He is immersed in QAnon. He is tweeting and retweeting all sorts of QAnon craziness.
Ditto Mike Flynn.
Chief
Mike.
Justice. Oh, yes. Well, Mike Flynn, of course, was there.
Yeah. You know,
they all assemble at this plantation in South Carolina. And this is, as you accurately call it, the brain trust that's feeding all these crazy conspiracy theories to Trump.
At one point, do they send via private jet a thumb drive to Trump in the White House with the, right. with these lunatic right. ideas about, you know, satellites.
They found some former security guard to Hugo Chavez. They yeah. taped him saying that 7 years earlier, he remembers being in a meeting where they were talking about putting secret algorithms in Smartmatic election machines, and Smartmatic was connected to Dominion. So therefore, that was the basis for the Venezuelan socialists rigging the election with secret algorithms. They get this video and they are pumped. Powell and Lynn Wood and Mike Flynn, they call up Trump. And this is one of many examples of where these people are talking directly to the president in the Oval Office. They get him on the line like that. And Trump is excited, you know, hey, you know, Powell says, the guys came through, we got the stuff. Great, Trump says, send it to me, get it to me as soon as possible. And that became, you know, central to the whole idea that there was something fishy in these Dominion election machines, which ultimately leads to the president's demands to seize the machines. Mike Flynn draws up the executive order to have the military do it, and ultimately to an actual illegal raid on this rural county in Georgia, Coffee County, to seize the software and the hard drives of Dominion voting machines to prove this crazy conspiracy theory about Venezuelan socialists. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, they were getting through to Trump. Trump is calling down. He calls down to Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell when they're planning their Jericho march to surround the governor's mansion, Governor Kemp's house, and blow horns until he relents and agrees to call a special session of the state legislature. You know, give him hell, Trump says. Go for it. And then, as you pointed out, the real craziness is this guy, Ron Watkins, who is like at the heart of QAnon. He's the administrator of the QAnon platform. You know, there was an HBO documentary that strongly suggested he was Q himself. Yes. We don't know that for sure, but he certainly was right in the middle of the, you know, crazy QAnon messaging. And he is calling in to Motley to talk to Powell, to talk to Wint. Would actually, Powell, in one of her lawsuits, even cites Ron Watkins as a computer expert who could testify to the corruption of the Dominion machines. So, QAnon played a much bigger role in all this than anybody realized.
So congratulations on the book. You also give evidence that, you know, we all are very familiar with the fact that Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss were, you know, horrendously harassed by Trump supporters. But what we didn't know until reading your book was that actual Trump employees, campaign employees, were part of the effort to intimidate and harass these women, which is they were paid to go to their homes. And it's so beyond appalling. All right. So, folks, I'm opening this up to the panel. This is the guy who is the leading candidate to be president again.
I just want to, first of all, commend Michael on his book. You have been at the top of my list for many, many years now as one of the best investigative reporters in the business. And you've done a great job in this book. What I want to ask you, though, and maybe this isn't your role, but maybe, you know, others will weigh in on it. Mona has just made the most salient point, which is despite what you describe, which is horrific. I mean, this is the greatest democracy in the world. We're talking about a man who would be president again, who is now, at least in some polls, leading in the race for the presidency. And yet we don't have serious discussion going on about what took place in Georgia and other states. And unfortunately, as you suggested, we now have seen the Georgia case devolve into a question of personal ethics on the part of Fani Willis in her personal relationship with Mr. Wade. We've also seen the judge in the case basically slapping down some of the counts, three of them, I think, against Trump himself in this case, basically suggesting that the prosecution didn't do its homework, didn't make the case about how Trump was asking the various officials to violate their oath of office. And despite plenty of evidence that, in fact, you know, all of these nefarious things took place, he nonetheless slapped down three of these charges. So what is going to happen in this campaign, you know, in which we cannot get serious discussion about some of the things that you detail in your book?
Well, a couple of thoughts. First of all, I mean, Judge McAfee threw out 6 out of 41 counts. I don't think it's quite as big a deal as some of the coverage has suggested, because the case remains intact. And the most serious charges are the racketeering conspiracy charges, and they all remain intact. And in fact, the specifics of the specific counts, which were individual counts that the judge dismissed, are all incorporated as part of the racketeering conspiracy. So the phone call, the fake elector scheme, the false testimony by Rudy Giuliani and others to the Georgia legislature about Ruby Freeman and her daughter, they're all still in the case. In the evidence will be, assuming the case goes to trial, would be presented in trial. So I'm not as worried about that. Obviously, the big decision is coming, you know, is the one on disqualification, which we can discuss. But as far as, you know, Trump's resiliency in coming back, I mean, it is, you know, pretty remarkable. Here we are in March of 24. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, what, November 22? When, you know, the great red wave didn't materialize, the people Trump endorsed failed across the country in spectacular fashion, including in Georgia, by the way. His animosity to Brian Kemp was so strong it caused him to back David Perdue, who got clobbered by Kemp in the Republican primary. Yes, it is amazing that Trump has been able to come back and is now, you know, for all intents and purposes, the Republican nominee for president and is even leading in the polls. There's a lot of reasons for that. You know, obviously, Biden's weakness and is a big part of it. And here's one that, you know, might be a little controversial, but I think that, you know, the first Trump's comeback in the polls started when Alvin Bragg indicted him in New York on what I think most people correctly view as the weakest possible case you can bring against Donald Trump, the least serious, the most trivial, and has all sorts of problems. And I think people saw that and said, wait, this is how you're going after him when there's so much more serious stuff that should be. And unfortunately, it now looks like that New York case is going to be the first case that goes to trial. Maybe the only. We're still waiting on the Supreme Court, of course. And if that's the case, I'm not sure a conviction in that case, which is likely, is going to make much of an impact. And I think it's like the wrong foot forward when there's so much more serious conduct by Donald Trump that needs to be presented in a courtroom than, you know, a hush money payment to a porn star. And so, you know, he may end up benefiting from that, if only the evidence, the much more important evidence in the other three cases could be presented. I think that could make the difference. And it is still, boggles the mind that one of our two major parties may end up nominating a convicted felon for president of the United States. It's something I don't think any of us could have imagined in years past.
There are many felons that I would prefer to this one, honestly. Okay, Bill Galston.
Well, it seems to me that at this point, the main question is not what the book says about Trump. but what the book implies about us. Because here we are, and although, you know, Michael's amazing findings certainly haven't penetrated the body politic, the general story has been out there for a very long time. One might have thought that people who were inclined to take that line of argument or that train of evidence seriously would already have reacted by indicating their opposition to the return of Donald Trump to the White House. That has not happened. And, you know, Trump is now leading in not only the national polls, which are pretty much irrelevant at this point, but in 6 of the 7 key swing states. If the election were held tomorrow, he would win. And it's no accident that Biden's State of the Union address insisted on the word comeback for the country and, by the way, for himself, right? Because he's behind, yeah. And I think he publicly acknowledged that he is. Given well-warranted concerns about the maintenance of democracy and constitutional institutions in the United States, this is extraordinary. And the only conclusion that I can draw from that is that for a plurality, if not majority, of Americans, this is background noise. And what matters more to them and what will drive their vote is their own condition, the condition of their family, the sense of whether the things in the country are under control or not, whether things in the world are under control or not. And right now, they are returning negative judgments on all of those questions, whether they be economic or international, and certainly immigration.
Yeah.
So I wish everybody in the country cared about the maintenance of democracy and constitutional institutions as much as the people on this show do, but it's manifestly not the case.
And there is something ugly about all this, and I think we tried to address that in the book. I mean, the threat level, the conspiracy mongering and the threat level. I mean, this had real consequences for people. I mean, you know, Ruby Freeman was driven from her home for 2 months at the recommendation of the FBI because she was being surrounded and assaulted by Trump supporters. And as Mona correctly pointed out, we report in the book, you know, people who had direct ties to Donald Trump's campaign. There was a time that in and of itself would have been a serious controversy that, you know, Trump would have had to have addressed. I mean, but and also the extraordinary threats that Fani Willis herself came under, which were real. I mean, you know, we start out the book with this incredible scene of the night of the indictment, when she's about to announce this indictment, that, you know, her people pick up threats on a MAGA website. The best time to kill her is when she's leaving the building. It was an assassination threat. And that was what she was dealing with when she was announcing these historic charges, and she goes back to the office, and they have this whole decoy operation with a body double who puts on her suit while she puts on civilian clothes, sweats, and a baseball cap, and she's smuggled out of her office in the back door, you know, while the body double wearing a bullet vest drives out, through the garage where the MAGA people were presumably expecting her. I mean, this is incredible stuff in American democracy, that, you know, a prosecutor doing her job has to be smuggled out of her office because of an assassination threat by supporters of the ex-president who she's indicting. And, you know, on and on it goes. And, you know, all I can say is it probably is background noise for most people and most of the electorate right now. I would agree with that. But I do think there is a value in doing what we did here, which is, you know, assembling it all, putting it into a coherent narrative, and putting the conduct each and every step of the way under a microscope. And I think when you do that, you see just what a really dangerous threat this was, and the enormity of what they were trying to do.
Michael, nothing I said was intended to diminish your accomplishment in any way. It's just it's a confession.
I didn't take it that
it's
way.
It's a confession. But, you know. It's a confession of despair and not a criticism.
Yeah.
Because if only we were faced with a problem of information, but I don't think we are. And let me just put one fact on the table to illustrate my skepticism on this point. According to a recent survey, 1 in 5 Americans who believe that Donald Trump in fact committed serious crimes are nonetheless prepared to support him for president. That's not an information gap. That's something else.
Right.
Damon, it's a kind of decadence, arguably, where, you know, Americans who take that view, you know, they soothe themselves by saying, oh, come on, they're all corrupt. Everybody does it. And because I'm not naive enough to think that every single major American political figure is a criminal, therefore I should vote for the criminal who I like. I mean, that is so antithetical to the America that I grew up loving, you know, that had some ideals, that understood it was imperfect, but still strove to be special and to be better and to uphold certain principles. And this kind of cynical, dark, you know, nihilism is just, I cannot wrap my brain around it, even though we've been discussing it and living it now for all these years. It's still very hard to assimilate.
Yeah, well, the Platonic dialogues are filled with characters like Thrasymachus and Callicles, who are sophists, who define truth as whatever advantages me. And if you go back and read Trump's Art of the Deal, you see that here's a man who's lived pretty much his entire career looking at the world exactly like that. Truth is whatever advantages myself, and falsehood is what gets in the way of me achieving my goals. The thing that, I mean, and I can totally see, you know, if I try to put my mind in the shoes of a man like that, in the weeks and couple of months after the loss in 2020, I can see how Trump would basically listen to anything anyone said to me that made it sound like, you know, somehow we're going to make this work out, that I actually win Georgia and Wisconsin and Arizona, and I'm going to actually be the president, continuing. That I, you know, even though I could never imagine actually looking at the world that way, I can imagine myself into the way Trump would view the world that way. And there were people very happy to feed him that. The thing that really kind of bothers me and really deeply worries me about the American people is Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell and my former boss, Rudy Giuliani, and Michael Flynn, who had very senior jobs in the military, in government, under President Obama for Michael Flynn. My question is, they're not Trump. They're not going to remain president if this is all true. Did they actually believe any of this? Like, because, you know, you see surveys about QAnon. I invoked some of them, like, I think 6 weeks ago on the podcast, showing rises across demographic groups of the number of Americans who believe QAnon. And I look out at the country and I think, you know, to take Bill's point about this isn't an information problem, even a step further, like, is there any reason to hope that even if all of the stuff in your, what sounds like an excellent book, Michael, were like broadcast day and night on the television, infomercials, specials in prime time explaining in detail all of what Trump did and the people around him did, it's not just that people would cynically say, yeah, everyone's corrupt, but they actually are so deeply enmeshed in a completely psychotic conspiratorial view of the world that it can't even penetrate. It's like another language. How widespread is that, and what is it? What is the case?
Okay, I have a bunch of thoughts on this, but it is a reminder. Everybody, I hope, if they read nothing else in our book, Chapter 6, the QAnon Commission, the craziness at Tamatli is, I think, maybe the most important takeaway. Did they believe it? Yeah, they convinced themselves to believe it because, you know, I mean, our politics is binary. You're with us or you're against us, you know, and this was, they were with Trump and they were going to do whatever Trump, whatever was needed to put Trump over the top. But there's a couple points I want to make about this. You know, I'm glad you brought up the art of the deal past of Donald Trump, because in our chapter on the perfect phone call from hell, where we go through how that phone call came about, who taped it and why, and what actually was said. And, you know, when you dissect it and step by step, it is so revealing into Trump's mentality, because he starts off trying to cajole Raffensperger. Come on, Brad, you know, we're all buddies here. Then he starts ridicule. They're laughing at you, Brad. You know, they're laughing at you because you won't change the votes. Then he gets, you know, ratchets up the pressure more and starts talking about, you know, it's very dangerous for you. You could be criminally prosecuted if you don't do this. And, you know, that's probably the moment where legally he may have crossed the line. He almost certainly crossed the line. But then what does he fall back on? And I think this is, you know, I think we say the most revealing line in the whole thing. You know, he's not getting anywhere. He's told Raffensperger, you got to recalculate. And Raffensperger is like, what is there to recalculate? We've run the numbers. There's nothing there. And he said, so what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break. He thinks it's a real estate deal. He just throwing, come on, guys, throwing 11,000 votes. We can all shake hands. It's the art of the deal that he was bringing, you know, the real estate negotiating tactics he always used to, come on, just throw in 11,000. What's 11,000 votes? Come on, you know, then we can get beyond this. But I want to give one little slender optimistic note that's worth remembering here. You know, Mona mentioned the young aide to Raffensperger, Republican consultant Jordan Fuchs, who on her own, knowing the danger that her boss is about to get himself into by talking with Donald Trump, somebody who is inevitably going to reinvent the conversation for his benefit, at a time, by the way, Trump is suing Raffensperger, so they were opposing litigants. Another reason, you know, to memorialize what got said in that phone call. She, on her own, without telling Raffensperger, without telling Trump, you know, without telling Mark Meadows, who set up the call, on her own, puts herself on mute, tapes the whole thing. And as a result, we have the most compelling evidence of Donald Trump's pressure campaign on state officials. And it's central to Jack Smith's case, as it's central to Fani Willis's case. But she's an example of something, which is, you know, remember, all those Republicans who Donald Trump thought he had in his pocket, when he asked them to cross the line, they all said no. Chris Carr, the Republican Attorney General, said he will resign if he was asked to defend a special session of the legislature. Brian Kemp, the Republican governor, when asked about the crazy Texas lawsuit to the Supreme Court to overturn Georgia's election, and, you know, Carr tells him there's no way we could be on board with that. And, you know, he says, well, and F him. He doesn't care. He actually says to somebody at the time, I don't give a shit what Donald Trump has to say. He stood the line. Raffensperger himself stood the line. So, you know, we call it a Republican stone wall that blocked what Donald Trump was trying to do in Georgia. And as much as we all should be acute to the dangers of another Trump presidency, it is somewhat heartening to remember that when Donald Trump asks people to break the law, and he didn't just do it in Georgia, he did in other states as well, state by state, official by official, Republicans weren't going to go there. And I suspect if we get another Trump presidency, I think, you know, there's some reason to think when he pushes and wants and demands people cross the line, there's going to be the same kind of resistance.
All right. We will we'll leave it there for now. Let's just say from your lips to God's ears. I hope that's true.
We'll see.
Yeah. But
But we're all waiting, obviously, for the decision of Judge McAfee on whether to disqualify Donald Trump. Fannie Willis. We'll see. I think if he does disqualify, I don't think he will, but we're going to find out soon enough. If he does not disqualify, the case goes forward and we're back to talking about the substance of what the case is all about and not the sort of irrelevant, salacious details. But if he does disqualify her, that pretty much kills the entire case. There's no prospect that another DA's office is going to be found because her whole office will have to be disqualified. There's no prospect that another DA's office would be found. And while that might not make a difference to Donald Trump, because presumably if he gets elected president, the Justice Department policy based in part on constitutional grounds that you can't prosecute a sitting president will remain in effect. But Georgia is the only case in which all of Trump's Confederates are also charged. Giuliani, Eastman, Meadows, David Schaefer down the line. And even if Trump gets elected, that won't go away. The case, there will be some accountability for Trump's Confederates. And that's another reason to hope that the Georgia case goes forward, because the Jack Smith case, all these other people are not charged. The Confederates are charged in this case. And that's another reason it's pretty important.
All right. Before moving on to our next topic, let's have a word about Babbel. So what is the best way to learn another language? Well, it's total immersion. You know, you get dropped in another country and you just have to sink or swim and you will learn a language very quickly. But most of us, even if we want to learn another language, and a lot of us say we do, we don't have that option. So what's the next best thing? Well, Babbel, because with just 15 minutes a day of doing online lessons with Babbel that employs native language speakers and has an interactive app where you start quickly engaging in conversation in a bunch of different languages, with just 15 minutes a day, you can be pretty conversant very quickly. Millions of language learners have enjoyed it across all age groups. Their conversation-based technique teaches you useful words and phrases to get you speaking quickly about things that you would actually talk about in the real world. So if you are, because of your business needs, would like to pick up another language, or if you are planning vacation to a country where you'd like to be able to converse on a basic level, it's a great, great app. So for our listeners, go to Babbel.com, that's Babbel.com/beg to differ, and get 55% off your Babbel subscription. That's 55% off at Babbel.com/beg to differ. And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. All right. Well, we were going to talk about TikTok. We went a little long in the first segment, so I think we'll leave that to the side. The Congress may or may not, the Senate rather, may or may not follow the House on banning TikTok. But I'd like to talk about Biden's reset, if it is one, since it follows very naturally from the conversation we were just having. We haven't spoken since the State of the Union, which most supporters of Biden found very encouraging. The president sort of belied the notion that he was senile and too feeble to run a campaign or to serve. On the other hand, the polls have not budged. He is still trailing Trump. And that is, Linda, despite the fact that not only all of the things that we know from Michael's book, but, you know, just in the last few days, Trump was seen mocking Biden's stutter. Now, remember in 2016 when he mocked that handicapped reporter and all of these Trump people and, you know, anti-Trump types, the people who said, oh, well, I wouldn't, they said, oh, you know, that wasn't true. He wasn't mocking him. And of course he was. Well, now there's just absolutely no doubt. And I was talking to an old friend who, like me, had been a Republican for decades. And we were talking about that clip. And he just said, you know, if that's what the people want, there isn't a damn thing we can do.
Well, I think it goes to Bill's point. The problem really is not Donald Trump. The problem is the American people and how degraded we've become. And, you know, I say this as somebody who has always considered myself very patriotic, enormous love for this country, always believed it was the best and that place in the world to have been fortunate enough to be born. But I've also been concerned for many years about the quality of our citizens and the way in which schools no longer teach some of the basics about American history, about American civics. We have people, you know, we've talked about this on the show. Well, I think most of us want to see the franchise exercised and enlarged. Some of us also want to see that the people who go to the polls are informed and are not driven by their gut. And that seems to be what's happening with Trump. I mean, he has not just the cult, the base of his followers, who I think will never budge. There is nothing that we could learn about Donald Trump that will move about 30% of the voting population who is just in his corner forever. But the number of people who support him based on a dislike for the other side, a distrust, a kind of tribal animosity that they have to people in the other party, that's what's ultimately going to determine this election. And the fact that, you know, there are a lot of people who feel that at least for the first couple of years of the Trump administration, the economy was doing well. People felt like they had more in their IRAs. They had more in their bank account. Prices were pretty good. They felt that their lives were better. And despite all of the data that we know shows that there have been enormous improvements in the U.S. economy and that the U.S. economy, when judged on the world stage, we're doing better than other countries, even in the inflation area, it doesn't seem to really be what's driving people. It's really their tribal affiliation, their dislike of what they consider the woke Democratic Party, and their belief that, you know, somehow the other guy is going to, you know, bring back the America that they look back fondly on.
Damon, something else happened this week. I wonder if you can comment on it. It was a few weeks ago that right at the end of our podcast, you delivered the news about the Herr report and, you know, the Robert Herr's report where he, you know, cast all these aspersions on Biden's mental acuity. Since then, we've had his testimony before Congress where he was batted around by both sides. But we've also seen the transcript. And tell me if I'm being too partisan here, but I do think you can make a pretty good case that Herr's characterization of Biden was very much open to doubt. I mean, there were certain things where Biden screwed up and definitely was, you know, mixing up dates and whatever. But there were also moments where he's very clear. And I just felt that the in context, these things are always, I'm not accusing her of bad faith necessarily. I'm just saying it's a matter of interpretation and spin. And I think he made it sound worse than it is. What do you think?
Well, maybe you should have gone to someone else on the panel. I don't know if I'm going to fully back you on
that's
that.
That's fine. You can beg to differ.
I'm not even going to beg to differ. I'll sort of like go like, I mean, did he need to announce his finding? in this investigation by including the most tendentious thing in there was the insinuation that, well, maybe we would bring a case, but we know that a jury would never convict him because he sounds like a doddering old man who could never complete a criminal conspiracy. They wouldn't believe he's capable of it. That's tendentious. So on that, that was gratuitous and unnecessary. The general portrayal of specific things in the transcript, I think, were broadly accurate. A lot of Democrats were really picking apart, he didn't forget when his son Beau died because he knew the date. Well, yeah, but he got the year wrong by a few years. As far as I'm concerned.
No. Sorry. I got to interrupt. He didn't get the date wrong. He said, what was the year? He remembered the month. And the day of the month, like May 30th, whatever it was, but he said, what was the year? So that was how it went.
Yeah, but in the context of the back and forth, it was clear that he was placing it like he couldn't get straight. Wait, was it after I was vice president? Was it why? He seemed, I thought, genuinely confused. One can also make the case on the other side, on the third hand, that of all the things he was talking about, a traumatic experience of this terrible grief is exactly the kind of thing that anyone would like maybe screw up the year on. Like, I lived through my father's death a couple of years ago, and it was Alzheimer's. It was very traumatic. And if in 10 years or 5 years even you ask me, what year did your father die in an interview? I might be like, when was that? I don't know. In general, I think both sides are very, very quick to kind of jump at anything and say, bad faith, you're being partisan, this is inappropriate, we're all on edge. And I sort of am left sort of, as I often am, in the middle ground, sort of like, just both of you calm down and just sort of, I just can't muster up any great anger or pique at her, but I also don't, I also don't think it was some great smoking gun proving that Biden is too old to be president. I think most people's opinions about that are a function of a million sound bites and images of hearing him in different settings, that's probably the more important thing. But not a great contribution to the, one side or the other of this this issue. I apologize.
No, that's fine. So, Bill, a few weeks back, Biden gave a really good speech. And I said, so Bill Galston, Biden gave a great speech. What do you think? And you said, well, he's going to have to do that every single week from now until November of 2024. And you were very dubious that he could. Same question, new speech, State of the Union. He rose to the occasion. I think you agree he rose to the occasion. Maybe you don't. And since then, he's out on the campaign trail. It seems like they're getting their feet under them a little bit in this campaign. They're starting to react swiftly to things that Trump says, et cetera. What do you think? Still very dubious or not?
Well, they're finally in campaign mode, much too late, in my opinion. Inexcusably late. Remember when Michael Dukakis took the month of August off?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
all of us oldsters remember that.
the Biden folks took at least 2 months off before starting the campaign. But more to the point, I think, not to my surprise, the State of the Union address didn't move the needle in public opinion. It rarely, if ever, does. Sometimes you get a spike that then subsides to the status quo ante. And sometimes, as in this case, you don't get a spike at all. Among other things, the viewership for the State of the Union address has been declining steadily. Most people are finding out about it in a mediated rather than direct way. What struck me about the speech was that it was a speech by a president who knows that job one is rallying his base before reaching out. And well might he think that, as we found out from the New York Times survey, not even 1% of Trump supporters in 2020 are going to do anything except vote for Trump. But that figure for Biden is 10%. I mean, if the 10% of his 2020 voters whom he's lost come back, you know, it's going to be a fair fight. If they don't, I don't see how he makes it up with inroads from undecided voters. The math just doesn't work out. So, I have not changed my opinion that he has to be a high energy campaigner week in and week out from now until election day to have a chance of getting back in the game. Whether he can do that on a sustained basis remains to be seen. One other point before I yield the floor. I think the Her story that you and Damon exchanged, you know, frank views on, is a classic Washington story. People had made up their minds about Biden's mental capacity to be president before the Her report. There is no evidence that the Her report convinced anyone to the contrary. Their views remained what they were. And by the way, there's no evidence that the State of the Union address net changed anybody's mind on that question. So public opinion may be from here on out somewhat less malleable than we imagine it is. And if so, that magnifies President Biden's challenge.
So, Michael, Bill mentioned that Biden rallied his own troops to a degree with the State of the Union. That is very important. I think he gave a little bit of heart to Democrats who were really, really frightened, and they felt a little bit better after that speech. So that's something that's one outcome of the speech, even if it didn't move the needle on the polling. Also, he got a huge fundraising boost out of it, which, you know, can't hurt. The fact is, a lot of the RNC's money is now going to be spent on Trump's legal bills. So there's that. Do you have any other takeaways from this?
Look, Biden did what he had to do. Rally the base. I think what he did was, calm the nerves of Democratic supporters who were really getting concerned about the age question. And he showed he could do it, you know, and still be a fighter. And I think that was something he had to do. My problem with the speech is sort of a different nature, which is, look, I mean, the State of the Union, you know, is sort of vaguely referred to in the Constitution. The State of the Union address has been this solemn occasion where presidents for decades have taken the matter seriously and tried to give, you know, with their own spin, you know, something resembling a state of the country, a state of the world, and all that. I mean, Biden turned it into a political stump speech, a convention speech. And I think, you know, once you do that, the tradition is gone. And, you know, this is going to be States of the Union speeches, you know, for the foreseeable future. And I think that's unfortunate. And, you know, we already have cable networks that won't air, you know, what Donald Trump says, because it's just a political speech. And, you know, and I think we'll get to the point where the State of the Union, why even air it? It's just a it's just a political speech. It's just let them pay for it if that's what the purpose of it is. So that's my thought about
State of the Union. So as somebody who's been against the State of the Union address forever, I mean, you know, I've always been with Jefferson, you know, mail it in. There's absolutely no need to be there in person.
Might be a good new tradition to start.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But and by the way, let's not forget that Trump took the occasion of one of his State of the Union addresses to give the Medal of Freedom to Rush Limbaugh. So, you know, come on. I mean, it's not nothing new here.
But Biden didn't start it, but he took it further than it had gone before.
All right. Let's leave that there and have a word from BetterHelp. So let's take a moment to talk about mental health. We all have struggles, but they don't have to control us. And therapy can be so helpful. It is not just for people with serious trauma or major illness. We all need a sympathetic, dispassionate listener, someone with experience and perspective who can reassure us that others have the same insecurities, doubts, and fears and have found ways to overcome them. Therapy helps us to figure out how our own minds may be holding us back. Ruminating about our worries and conflicts or the many balls we're trying to keep in the air doesn't help. It just contributes to the stress. And self-medicating with booze or drugs is a dead end. Therapy can help unwind your worries and let you be a calmer, happier version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, BetterHelp is a great option. It's incredibly convenient because it's entirely online, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and get started. If that therapist isn't a good fit, you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. It's the gift you give yourself. Make your brain your friend with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/begtodiffer today and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/begtodiffer. And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. All right, come to our final segment, highlight or lowlight of the week. Damon Linker.
Well, in the spirit of trying to drill down a little bit into President Biden's struggles and why so many of us on the show are a little worried, there was a very good piece in the Financial Times this week by a journalist called John Byrne Murdoch, titled "American Politics is Undergoing a Racial Realignment." He draws on a lot of survey evidence. There are many charts and graphs in this piece, looking at this question, showing Black voters, Latino voters drifting away from the Democratic Party, where they have found a home for quite a long time, and that this is ceasing to be the case. I know Bill brings this up or aspects of it lots of times on the podcast, but this is a really good distillation of the latest data on it. So I highly recommend it. Listeners can check the show notes. I will put a link to the FT version of it, but that's notorious. A publication where you need a paying subscription to read. But thankfully, Byrne Murdoch, the author, did a long, very exhaustive Twitter X thread distilling a lot of his charts and arguments in it. And I've put it in a thread reader form for you to read. So listeners should be able to see that as well. And that'll be in the show notes also.
Thank you. Michael Iskoff.
Lowlights count.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's well the era highlights. We're living in, Michael.
Yeah, I'll go with, it was already mentioned, but Trump trying to imitate and ridicule Biden's stutter. Just another reminder that he's the neighborhood bully kid who you tell your own children to stay away from and be anything, be the opposite of who they are. It was just like an appalling example of a guy who, you know, lacks the kind of basic decency we all should admire.
Amen. Linda?
Well, I have a low light, and it's actually been a low light on a theme that we've discussed a lot on the program, and that is the way in which Israel is being targeted now as a kind of pariah state. And the most recent example, and there are so many, it's hard to pick one, but this was from the literary world, and it was from a magazine called Guernica, which is named after the famous Picasso painting having to do with the Spanish Civil War and the town that was bombed by the Germans, the Nazis, during that Civil War. It was a town filled mostly with women and children. Well, this magazine is, you know, it's on the left. I mean, most literary magazines are on the left. Well, this week they did a really, I think, horrible thing, and it's the kind of thing we see a lot coming out of the woke left. There was an article that was printed in the magazine by a young woman, Joanna Chen, was entitled "From the Edges of a Broken World," and she is a woman who translates Hebrew and Arabic poetry. She lives in Israel, was born in London, but lives in Israel. And she was talking about what had happened in the aftermath of October 7th and then the campaign in Gaza and her efforts to reach out to people in her world that she had worked with and how difficult it was because of what is taking place in Gaza. It was, if anything, critical of Israel. But there was such a hue and cry from the staff of the magazine Guernica that they actually withdrew the essay because 10 members of the mostly volunteer staff quit. This is the kind of trying to quiet voices and trying to make Israel somehow the absolute pariah state in all of the world that I think is very scary. And is unfortunately, we're seeing some support for this in the most pro-Palestinian elements of the Democratic Party, and it concerns me. So the article, a very good article about this, appeared in the New York Times by Mark Tracy, and we'll post a link to that. But I think this just exemplifies what's happening in terms of the way in which the aftermath of October 7th, we've totally forgotten the 1,200 Israelis who were slaughtered in that terrible day. And now the focus is all on making Israel the pariah.
Thank you. Bill Galston.
Well, it will not surprise you to learn that I have a low light to add to the conversation. Highlights being hard to come by these days. Commentary on our days, I fear. The state of Michigan is arguably going to be the most important state in the 2024 presidential elections. Why do I say that? Trump is running way ahead of Biden in the southern tier swing states, Georgia, Nevada, and Arizona. Biden, I think, has fair chances of carrying Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. But in Michigan, which he carried by almost 3 points in 2020, he's now trailing on average by 3.5 points. While we were on the air, the Quinnipiac University poll on Michigan, the latest version, was released. And it spells trouble for Biden. He's behind Trump by 3 points in the two-way race. And more to the point, he's trailing Trump by 5 points in the five-way race. In the five-way race, he gets only 53% of the Michigan black vote. 53%. But even more startling, you know, poll after poll, national polls have been coming out showing Trump getting roughly 1 in 5 black votes, if not more. And we've all been shaking our heads and saying, no, that's not possible. Well, in Michigan, it is possible. Because in this survey, in the head-to-head results, Donald Trump was getting 19% of the black vote, which means for all practical purposes, 19% of the vote of people who live in Detroit. This will be an earthquake if it's actually borne out by Election Day results. You know, a group that's been 95-5 for Democrats for quite some time now is trending in the other direction. And I think it's a sign that after a very long time in which race trumped class, we're now entering a world where class may well trump race. That is certainly true with the Hispanic vote, but if it becomes true with the African-American vote as well, we are in an entirely new political era.
Okay, thank you. Well, folks, believe it or not, I do have a highlight, sort of a backhanded highlight. But I noticed a story this week that the federal government, the FBI, raided a federal prison, a women's prison in the north of California, a town called Dublin, California, about 40 miles east of San Francisco. The reason for the raid is that this prison is notorious for abusing its inmates. Somebody called it the rape club. The warden has been replaced. But why is this a highlight? Look, nobody likes to stick up for inmates, for prisoners. These are all criminals. They all did bad things. That's why they're there. And it's for, you know, people don't like to be advocates for people who are criminals. But The fact is, criminals are people too, and they are sentenced to be punished for their crimes. They are not sentenced to be raped. They are not sentenced to be sodomized. They are not sentenced to be sex slaves for the wardens, who then lie about it and use their power to silence those or punish those who attempt to be whistleblowers. And so this was a story about the system working to some extent, because there were complaints. The AP did a deep dive and reported on this. This got to the attention of Congress. Senators of both parties put pressure on the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice, in time, acted. It's one small slice of what it means to live under the rule of law, where at least there's some hope that, you know, even if it's very slow and even if it's very imperfect, that you can reform something like this. If we lose that, if the press isn't free to report, and if the, you know, members of the Justice Department are all corrupt political officials, there's no hope of anything like this ever happening. So I just want to say congratulations to the FBI and the Department of Justice for acting on behalf of people who cannot speak up for themselves most of the time, and for correcting a terrible, grievous miscarriage of justice. You know, that's the way things are supposed to happen, and hopefully we won't destroy it. With that, I want to thank our guest, Michael Iskov, and our regular panel, also our producer, Jim Swift, and our sound engineer, Jonathan Siri. Also, our wonderful listeners and viewers, and we will return next week, as every week.